Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I am your host, Sam Vecini. We are presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, it is Adam Spinella here. We're going to dive deep into the Donovan Mitchell trade that occurred. I guess that was 2 hours ago, 3 hours ago, something like that, Spins?
Something like that. Time is moving pretty slowly when all I'm doing is sitting here and refreshing the Twitter feed for the last few hours. So something like that.
Well, and for such a big blockbuster, we decided that going live would be the fun thing to do here. So right now we're live on YouTube. Please, everyone, come join, come share the link, do everything that is associated with that. But let's just kind of jump into this first. So before we do that, I just want to note that I had some dental work done yesterday and I'm drinking coffee with a straw. And I'm still learning how to talk again after you get dental work done. So I'm kind of slurring my S's a little bit and trying to figure out how do I talk again? That's always a fun aspect of going to the dentist and having actual work done.
Yeah, Sam, you sound good. You look just as good. I think you're doing all right.
Oh, that's nice. That's great. So the trade here is Donovan Mitchell going to the Cleveland Cavaliers for Colin Sexton, who has been signed and traded here in a 4-year, $72 million contract, Lauri Markkanen, Ochai Agbaji, as well as Cleveland's 2025, 2027, and 2029 unprotected first-round picks, in addition to pick swaps in 2026 and 2028. I know what my immediate reaction was. I texted you my immediate reaction. I was a little bit confused. I think I was still a little bit groggy from waking up. But what was your immediate reaction when you saw this deal?
My immediate reaction was, why didn't I see this coming sooner? That the sign and trade piece from Sexton really made Cleveland an ideal type of fit. I thought that the timeline really sunk up for the Cavaliers. Yep. Of adding a younger star, still a little bit on the upward trajectory in Donovan Mitchell, with a guy like Darius Garland, who's hitting his extension year soon, and Evan Mobley, who's just coming off of a fantastic rookie campaign. So the yep. timeline of staggering some of the salaries, adding young stars, really, really made sense to me. I know we'll talk about it a little bit more with Cleveland about what they gave up in order to make that happen. I think that as a smaller market type of team, you just, whatever you have to do in order to land a star via trade, when the timing fits, when the window is open to do so, you take advantage of it. And I think that's what Cleveland did here.
So my immediate reaction was wait, what? And it's funny because I had thought about Cleveland in regard to a Donovan Mitchell deal. And I think the reason that I don't want to say I thought less of it or I'm not in on it. I think it's a good deal for Cleveland. I think it makes sense for Cleveland to go down this road for a number of reasons. But I think the reason that I didn't quite connect the dots quite as much as someone for instance, Kyle Mann talked about this a while ago on, I think it was the Ringer NBA show. And of course, Kyle, and he nailed it, a sign and trade for Sexton. I think he even mentioned Markkanen, which makes sense because they needed the Markkanen money involved, and then picks, obviously. Shout out Kyle, just a terrific person. But I think the reason that I didn't quite associate it is I thought that they would go hunting for a wing more than another guard that is a little bit ball dominant next to Darius Garland. But here's the thing that I think I kind of forgot. Early this year, Cleveland was extremely successful playing with Ricky Rubio next to Darius Garland. And I thought it was their most successful run of this past season. And I think you're going to see a pretty similar kind of dynamic where Darius Garland is terrific playing both on and off the ball. Like, yep. Cleveland loves to start him off the ball and run him off of like all sorts of, you know, crazy off ball actions, like baseline screens. And they'll run him off of like some wing screens where they'll try and get him like in a dribble handoff to get moving before he touches the ball. Like, he is a really, really impressive off ball guard. He's, you know, we talk about Trae Young not really moving off the ball as like a similar player to Darius Garland. Trae's better than Darius Garland, but like is a similar prototype player, archetype of player. The difference between the two, other than like Trae Young being drastically better on the ball, because Trae Young is like one of the best on-ball players I think the NBA's ever seen, is that Darius Garland really moves off the ball. And I think that that's why, you know, I'm a little bit worried about the fit with DeJounte Murray and Trae Young in general, but I'm less concerned about the Darius Garland-Donovan Mitchell fit, because I think that both Donovan and Darius have very real experience at this point playing off the ball and have had a lot of success at this point playing off the ball. I think that all of it just kind of works in terms of the way that those two will work offensively. Like, that dynamic, I think, is going to be pretty strong. Defensively, I think, is why maybe I didn't always connect this in the way that maybe I could have. I do have some significant concerns about Darius Garland and Donovan Mitchell playing together defensively, in the same way that for many years now I've been talking about my concerns with Darius Garland and Colin Sexton playing together defensively in Cleveland. But Donovan Mitchell is just way better than Colin Sexton. Like, it's, yeah, a significant upgrade. So does the offensive upgrade in the fit that they're going to have offensively, which I think is pretty real, does that counteract the defensive concerns I have? I think it does. I think it does for me, but I also think that this does some like weird things where it might limit what they can do moving forward, because like you also really kind of are committed now to the Jared Allen, Evan Mobley like combination big alignment. And I worry that like not Jarrett Allen or Evan Mobley alone are good enough rim protectors to counteract that backcourt defensively. The two of them together, I think, can do it. And that's why I like this Donovan Mitchell trade a little bit more for Cleveland than I would have liked it for the Knicks. And we'll talk about that later on. But I think my immediate reaction at the end of the day is kind of similar to what you said. You're the Cavs. You have a chance to go out and get Donovan Mitchell. You're giving up a lot of what right now you probably grade as like B level assets as opposed to A level assets, and you get a chance to do it. Now, I have some concerns, and we'll talk about that in the Utah section in terms of like why I think that this works for Utah. But yeah, I get it. I get it for Cleveland in a way that I was concerned about not getting it for Cleveland whenever I originally saw the deal.
Well, I think part of why the picks don't hurt as much as it might seem on the surface level is because Evan Mobley and Darius Garland and Jared Allen, yeah, are all-star caliber type of players already and have so much more room for growth both individually and together. The Cavs aren't going to
long term too.
They're locked in. Like, the Cavs are not going to be able to find another really good star player type of asset through the draft. What they got this year with Oshae Igbaji at 14 is probably the highest draft pick they'll have for the coming 5-6 years. So I always say, when you're talking about mass first round picks going in a deal, it's about the quality of the pick, not just the quantity of them. They are unprotected, which leaves Cleveland a little bit thin in case there's some injury, some happenstance that might propel them in a different direction. But I do believe that these are, you know, this is the time to make that type of deal, because like you said, all of the players are cost controlled in terms of their contracts. And a guy like Mobley is only going to continue to get better on the offensive end of the floor. Garland is hitting his stride right now and a really, really unique piece. And the offensive stuff just fits. I think Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland are a fantastic pairing because they can play your turn, yeah, my turn. They can play off of each other. Having two big men with them will allow the Cavaliers to really play different types of pick and roll styles, one on one side of the floor, quick swing to the other wing, step up ball screen on that end. They can do a lot of different things offensively. And this is, you know, an underrated piece of this to me. I'm a big fan of going out and buying or spending a lot of money on your star players and saying, we'll figure out the role pieces later, because you can find them on cheaper, more economical contracts. And because there's such star power, such good offensive creation and defensive security behind, I know we'll talk about the defense in a minute, but because of that, it's very simple for each role player who comes into Cleveland to know what's expected of them, how to find those players, and what they're going to be asked to do. That makes the team building long-term really simple.
Yeah, and you brought up the idea of just getting your star players. I mean, this Cavs team now has three all-stars on it in Donovan Mitchell, Darius Garland, Jared Allen. There's only one team in the NBA outside of the Cavs that had three all-stars in 2022. That's the Golden State Warriors. And oh, by the way, the Cavs' like best asset is Evan Mobley, and he doesn't even count within that stat. So the Cavs are loaded in terms of like real high level talent. And the thing that I think is biggest here is like, you could point to Donovan Mitchell, Jared Allen, Darius Garland. You could say that those guys are like, you know, A-minus level assets that like aren't quite going to be good enough to win a title. That like that, you know, if you pair all of those guys together, you're looking at like a 50 win team that maybe is like the 4 or 5 seed. The differentiating factor here is Evan Mobley. Like, there is an upside and there is a world where Evan Mobley is the dude, where like he actually gets you to the title. And I think that is what Cleveland is betting on here as much as anything. You brought up the idea of timing, and you think that this is the right time for Cleveland. Is it? Like, are you sure about that? I think it is. Like, I think I agree with you that like, this team should have made the playoffs last year, and they were really good throughout 75% of the year, let's say. Yep. And they have real talent now. But is this like 2 years too? Is it a year too early to like push? Because this deal pushes all of their assets long term into the table. Right. Like, it's going to be harder for them to maneuver in 2025 through 2029. With all of the assets that they've moved out for Donovan Mitchell, and you figure 2025 to 2029, that's probably when this team's actually going to be competing for a title. Probably not this year, although I think that like there's an outside chance that like they could win 55 games and like make it work if Evan Mobley takes like an enormous leap. But I think realistically, like, you know, you're waiting until Evan Mobley is 23, 24 years old. Donovan Mitchell's 28 years old. Darius Garland is 24, 25 years old. That's probably more when your window is. So I guess I just ask, like, is this a year too early, or like 2 years too early, given that Donovan Mitchell is only signed through, I believe, 2025 at this point?
Yeah, and I get that. I certainly understand that perspective, because, you know, this doesn't instantly vault the Cavaliers into contender status, that you're making this star trade and mortgaging your future for a little bit of development that is needed from the rest of the guys you already have in order for you to get to that championship level. So it may feel a bit early in that regard, but two things really make me believe this is the right time for it. One is the Colin Sexton piece, that being able to include him contractually through sign and trade isn't something that Cleveland might have the ability to do in the future, that there's just going to be a shortage of bigger contracts that are needed to send out in order to get a star player, particularly as the cap might take another jump or two in another couple of years. That's going to be harder to come by in the future. So without giving up one of Allen or Garland and a really important piece, or sending more picks if you're going to send Kevin Love out in a deal like that, this was really the right time to take advantage of it this summer. The second thing for me is, you never know when another star player like this is going to come available again, who is an all-star, who fits the timeline window, and who does have such good offensive synergy with the all-star and point guard of the future that the Cavs already have in Darius Garland. Yeah. So to me, it's less about timing of how are they going to compete for a championship in the next year or two. It's we don't know if this opportunity is ever going to come available again. We have to make our swing at it right now.
I think you're right. I think you're right about that. I think that this is a swing the Cavs had to make. I think that the assets they gave up, while concerning and like could end up being very bad depending on how things go, I think that they had to do this. Given that Donovan Mitchell's under contract longer term, it's a good fit. He is a perimeter player as opposed to like Minnesota going all in on a big in today's NBA, which I think is important. And here's the thing, like Donovan Mitchell has been bad defensively for a couple of years now. Donovan Mitchell has not always been bad defensively. Like, he was good defensively at Louisville. He was pretty good defensively his first year in the NBA. There could be, like, some room for upside there. Like, I don't know if I buy that entirely, but, like, he has shown the capacity to be a good defender before. And I kind of think that that, like, has a chance to come back at least. I don't know. That backcourt pairing defensively is going to be very odd and interesting to track moving forward. I do think Donovan is a better pairing for Garland defensively than Sexton is, because Donovan is stronger than Colin. Like, he's just much stronger, much more physical, longer, everything like that. How many games do we think this team wins this year? Like, do we think that they're a top three seed in the East? Do we think that they have a chance, like, at the number one seed? Do we think that they're, like, you know, still below Miami and, like, the five seed? Like, where are you at on this Cavs team?
Yeah, real quickly on the defense first, Sam. I think that, you know, perimeter defense and foot speed and all the issues that they may have in one-on-one situations with Garland and Mitchell on the floor together does have some concern. But this is the most uniquely built roster in terms of rim protection and interior presence defensively. That in Utah, the issues that the Jazz ran into in the postseason was teams could go five out and take Rudy Gobert away from the rim. And now the way that Utah built their roster, they had so many perimeter sieves and guys that couldn't keep anybody in front that once Gobert is out of the lane, the rim is unoccupied. People are slashing through them left and right. In Cleveland, you can lift Jared Allen away to the corner and try to do the exact same thing in a five-out scheme, but you still got Evan Mobley on the weak side ready to roam and protect that lane. That having two bigger guys who are so instinctual and can protect the basket, really, it helps me get over some of the defensive concerns, because this is the absolute right infrastructure meant to protect offensive pieces like Donovan, like Darius, while giving them a lot of versatility to guard in different ways still, because Mobley can play on the perimeter and be just fine.
And on top of that too, I do want to note that, look, Jared Allen is better in a drop coverage scheme than he is like out on the perimeter, like on an island with guards. He got better at that this year though. Like, and he got better rotationally around the basket this year. He is a really high level defender now who has really improved his versatility as a defender now. I think that that is an enormous aspect of this deal. And again, that's why I kind of like it more for the Cavs than I do for the Knicks to acquire Donovan Mitchell and pair him with a smaller guard. Like, the Knicks would have paired him with Jalen Brunson, right? And you would have similar issues, but the Cavs infrastructure is just drastically different and drastically better, frankly, than what New York's is. And I think that they're better suited to compete in the next 3 years than the Knicks are with Donovan Mitchell. So in terms of like where they are in the East, like, I do think this is a top four team in the East now on paper, at the very least. Like, we don't know how it's all going to come together entirely, but I would say this is a top four team in the East on paper.
Yeah, I think I have them right around that like 4 to 5, maybe 4 to 6 range. I think, you know, Milwaukee, Philly, and Boston are in a little bit tougher of a tier to me that they're not just not quite ready for in terms of experience. Miami is a little bit up and down to me, but I have them kind of penciled in right now as that number four spot. And then I think there's like a Cleveland-Toronto arms race kind of going on for which young players develop the fastest, what identity are they able to really produce that helps them win games in a postseason series to see who takes that leap forward first.
Yeah, I think that my immediate take is, look, Philly, I think, is a better playoff team, weirdly, than like a regular season team, just because Joel is going to miss time in the regular season, right? Like, and it's just hard for them to win when Joel is out. Obviously, they're going to be hoping for more from James Harden. And if they get more from James Harden, you know, their regular season fortunes could change a little bit. But I wonder if, like, we see a circumstance where Philly is a little bit more successful of a playoff team and, you know, the Cavs take a year of, like, taking their lumps a little bit in the playoffs, right? But maybe they win more games in the regular season than Philly. I don't know. Like, I think that Cleveland ends up with a home playoff series. I think that's my take immediately from this. I think they end up with a home playoff series with Donovan Mitchell, and they have room for growth beyond that because Evan Mobley is not going to be at his peak at 21 years old, 22 years old. That is really the differentiating factor here. Like, Evan Mobley being so good, so young, and being such an elite defender that I think has real upside offensively, that's it. Like, that's the key to me. He can be the guy on a title team if his development goes right in the next 2 to 3 years. And I don't know that the Knicks have that. I don't think Utah ever had that. Cleveland does have it, and I think it's like the key factor here in them being able to take this swing. Let's move to Utah now. Because I think the entirety of this deal for Utah is a bet that Donovan Mitchell will not like living in Cleveland and will want to leave in 3 years. Like, that's it. Like, the way that they have structured the draft assets in this deal is 2025 unprotected, 2027 unprotected, 2029 unprotected. Donovan Mitchell's deal runs out, I believe, in 2025. And I will just note very briefly on the Cavs front. So right now, the Cavs have two designated rookie extensions on their books with Donovan Mitchell and Evan Mobley. Donovan Mitchell theoretically has 4 years left on his deal, but has a player option after three, if I remember correctly on this front. Or it's something like that. Like, the way that it could work, like, Donovan could opt into his player option and theoretically cause problems with Cleveland, like getting Evan Mobley locked into a designated rookie extension. I would venture, and I can almost guarantee you this was the Cavs' idea, that there's no way Donovan Mitchell is like Donovan Mitchell could drop off like 25% from where he is now. And with the way that the TV money is going to improve across the league, my guess is that it's still going to be advantageous for Donovan Mitchell to opt out of that deal. Like, that's kind of it at the end of the day. So I think that the designated rookie extension idea does not really play a role within this deal, even though on the books, like, you could theoretically see it playing a role. Moving to Utah, though, this is a bet on just Donovan Mitchell not wanting to stay in Cleveland after 2025, I think, at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's a unique way, and I think it's a smart way to structure how they're going to go about getting their picks and handling a lot of those situations. If I'm, you know, the Utah Jazz here, I have to look at this in terms of really the last two. We got a new guest here. Look at this.
Yeah, we have a guest. This is Penny. She decided to bang down the door with her 5-pound muscles.
Well, you know, and Sam, we're just talking here about kind of picks and how I think things go for Utah with looking at this as a combination of the Mitchell and Gobert trades for a second in terms of what they've brought in, right? And, yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it ends up being 7 future first round picks. Kessler and Egbaji would make that 9 as guys who haven't really played in the NBA yet.
3. I would argue Bolmaro is 10.
Bolmaro would be 10. 3 pick swaps. I believe, what was it? 1 in this deal and, or sorry, 2 in this deal and 1 in the Gobert.
I'll pull up the Gobert exact details, but I think that you're right on that.
So that ends up being, you know, a swap doesn't really add a young player to you. It just gives you a more advantageous position to pick one. But really what we're looking at here are is a total haul of first round picks for two players that you felt inevitably were going to move on, while also adding a couple intriguing younger guys to that roster. Like I think Jared Vanderbilt, Talen Horton Tucker, who they ended up really flipping just an asset that they got in that Gobert trade for. I think Colin Sexton is still young enough to be somewhat intriguing if surrounded by the right pieces. This is a gamble on future and upside that Utah is certainly making. They want to enter the new frontier in the NBA, which is when you decide to tank, you go this Sam Presti, Hinkie style, just accumulate as many future draft picks as you can. And it's okay to sit on those for a while and use them as you see fit by the time your roster is ready to start maturing. And that's what Utah's really going to do here.
Well, it's the Danny Ainge style more than anything. Like, I mean, he did it before Presti did it, right? Like this is always what he's done. He's tried to accumulate as many unprotected picks as possible, get as many bites at the apple as he can and figure it out from there. I think it's a interesting play. Look, they've done an exceptional job of rebuilding their asset chest, and they still have more, by the way, that they can do. And we'll get to that in a moment. And I think they're going to probably even get a couple more first round picks whenever they clear out the rest of this roster. Yeah, I mean, three unprotected first round picks from the Cavs. It's valuable. I think here's the thing. Is three unprotected picks in 2025, 2027, and 2029 from the Cavs more valuable than two unprotected Knicks picks, given what we know about like the Knicks roster right now, their just overall organizational, the James Dolan of it all, let's call it. Like, I think the Knicks actually have done like a really competent job with their front office. Yeah. Like, I don't mean this as a slight at like Leon Rose. I don't mean this as a slight at the players on the roster. Like, I think that the front office, since they've taken over, has actually done like a pretty good job. I just wonder, like, that organization is perpetually unstable under James Dolan. Like it's just the reality of the situation. I'm sorry. I feel bad saying it. I just wonder if two unprotected Knicks picks might be more valuable than three unprotected Cavs picks as the Cavs move into this Evan Mobley led era where they also have Darius Garland, who's an all-star, and now also have Donovan Mitchell and the potential to re-sign Donovan Mitchell moving forward.
Yeah. Part of this too is not just the three Cavs picks versus two from the Knicks. It's the Colin Sexton versus whatever salary pieces you would get for the Knicks, assuming that that might be an RJ Barrett. I know the extension kind of threw a little bit of a wrench in some of those negotiations, potentially. But I don't know where I'd stand on three Cleveland picks versus two New York. I think that's pretty close. But I do know I would much rather have a guy like RJ Barrett than any current asset that the Cavaliers could have thrown at me if I'm Utah.
Yeah, I get that. I don't know. I'm in on RJ. Like, that's the thing. Like, and we'll talk about RJ at the end, but like, and I want to talk about his extension at the end, but like, I just, this is a weird deal for Utah where it's just like, if Donovan Mitchell stays in Cleveland, like this is not a good deal for the Jazz. I don't think. Like, I think they would have done better doing the Knicks deal. But like, it's always what Danny Ainge was going to do. Whoever gave him the most unprotected picks, he was going to do that deal. That's what his style is. That's what his mentality is on this thing. And I get it. I just worry about Evan Mobley is really good. That's kind of what I keep coming back to. Yeah. Like, if you're Utah, you're betting on a team with Evan Mobley and like now three all-stars surrounding Evan Mobley, all of whom are 25 and under. I think Jared Allen is 25 still. He might be 26, I guess. You're betting on that team failing. And Evan Mobley still has like 8 years left of team control, because I'm sure he's going to sign a 5-year max, right? Like that would make sense. I get it. I get why he did this. Also, there might just be a part of it where like the Knicks were fucking around and he got sick of dealing with the Knicks, right? Like, and this is like not a like tangibly worse deal. I don't know if it was so like the final deal that Shams reported over on TV earlier today was RJ Barrett, Emmanuel Quickley, 2 unprotected firsts. And like you would assume that Evan Fournier was in that deal somehow. Look, I can't imagine that if it came down to it, like, look, this was not reported. This is now me speculating. I can't imagine if it came down to it, the Knicks would be like, no, Obi Toppin is our breaking point. Like, I would bet that they probably could have gotten Obi Toppin in that deal, given the way that they've utilized Obi so far. It has nothing to do with, like, how good Obi Toppin is. It has to do with the fact that, like, up until the last 10 games of last season, they misutilized him since they acquired him. So, like, you can get all of that, or you can do the Cavs deal where you get Colin Sexton, who's pretty good. Like, I think Colin Sexton is going to put up numbers in Utah. Like, Colin Sexton is going to put up 25 points a game, probably on like league average efficiency, because that's what he does. That's who Colin Sexton is. Lauri Markkanen is a valuable player. Like, he's a, you know, starting power forward in today's NBA because of his ability to space the floor. Oshai Agbaji is like a good flyer, good wing defender, you know, good 3-and-D guy. I don't see him as anything more than somewhere between like a 5th and 8th man on a roster. Like it's like getting I like him a little bit less than I like Quentin Grimes, for instance, is an asset. And it seems like the Knicks like weren't necessarily offering Quentin. I don't know. Like I like the overall haul that Utah got for Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert. I just wonder if I would have rather bet on the organizational instability of the Knicks over this Cavs roster with Evan Mobley.
Yep, and I certainly understand that. I think with RJ Barrett, and this is something that I'm just, you know, speculating and thinking on right here. If you're Utah, do you think that acquiring him either just with his timeline of when he's going to start aging and being a really good player puts him out of the ability to be part of that rebuilt core? And therefore, hey, I'd rather take an extra pick, some other young assets and a guy like Agbaji and salary filler from a guy like Colin Sexton long-term, as opposed to RJ, who we've got to pay for a while. We may win a few more games and we'd like the next couple of years. And then by the time we've rebuilt this thing, he's 27, 28, not sure if the timelines sync up. Like, I don't know if they're thinking that far in advance or if that enters their mind at all. I think RJ is clearly the superior player. I agree with you. I would have preferred that Knicks package to the Cleveland one. It's close. I think I'd prefer the Knicks one. But I don't know if RJ's contract and timeline situation of being the best player for right now matches up with a complete overhaul and rebuild.
But it doesn't really with Sexton or Lowry either, though, right?
No, but I don't think you acquire them to be those linchpin pieces, right? You acquire them to help bridge the gap over the next few years, and you're taking the extra pick, a guy like Agbaji getting thrown in as a younger guy that has team control for 4 years.
Yeah. No, you're right. I get that. Like, I think RJ is going to be a little bit more flippable. I think that RJ is going to you could move RJ in the future in a way that, like, look, we kind of just saw how valuable Colin Sexton is around the league this summer, right? Like, you know, he was a free agent. I don't think the Cavs if he would have signed an offer sheet somewhere, like, I don't know if Cleveland would have matched, put it that way. Like, they might have just been like, let's roll over the asset. But like, I'm not sure that they would have. I don't know. I think I would have rather had the Knicks deal if I was Utah, but, you know, nonetheless, like, they are now set to rebuild moving forward. Like, they have Walker Kessler, they have Oshai Agbaji, they have Talen Horton Tucker, who's like an interesting piece now, although I'm a little bit less interested in Talen Horton Tucker than I was a week ago, because you've acquired Colin Sexton, who's going to dominate the ball. Now the question comes for Utah: where are you shipping all of these other guys? Because like there's no way that Bojan Bogdanović should start the year on the Utah Jazz roster. There's no way that like Mike Conley should start the year on the Utah Jazz roster. Jordan Clarkson as well. Like there's no rhyme or reason for these guys to be around. Like, so I think that like the Lakers are obviously a fit here. Like if you could do, you know, Bojan and Mike Conley, Bojan and Jordan Clarkson for Russell Westbrook, and then like you get a pick in like a second round pick or something like that, right? Like that probably makes some sense. Maybe like a pick and a pick swap from the Lakers for those two. You know, there are a lot of teams I think that would really love Bojan at the end of the day. Like, I think that he's a really valuable player. He's one of the best spot up shooters in the NBA. He's one of the best, you know, he's one of the most underrated scorers, I think, in the NBA. Defensively, there are concerns, but like there are teams that can insulate him defensively in a pretty real way. This is a fascinating core moving. Like, I wonder if, like, if you're Phoenix, would you consider doing like Cam Johnson and like Dario Saric for Bojan? Because like it is a significant upgrade on Cam Johnson. As much as like I like Cam Johnson, but like I'm just like kind of think like I think that comes pretty close money wise.
Yeah.
You know, if you're Utah, you're getting Cam Johnson. Cam Johnson might not fit their age timeline. Now that I think about it, but like, you know, you get him for a longer term deal, hopefully, and like you kind of make that work.
Yeah, I mean that's an interesting one. To me, it all comes back to what is Utah best served doing with some of their veteran assets now? Is it trying to bundle them together and make one bigger haul, or is it doing individual deals where you send Bogdanović one place, you send Conley to another? You know, with the that clearly impacts the Lakers, and that's where I think the urgency is going to be on here over the next several weeks before we get into training camps of, are the Lakers going to be able to pull this deal out? Can they find a way to get these guys? Because they're the one team that has urgency to take both back. Cause I don't think they,
what this deal does though, it creates a bidding war. Like the race is now on to like get Bojan. The race is now on to get like some of these guys out of Utah. And like, we can talk about like how valuable they are, but I would imagine like four or five teams called the Jazz immediately after the deal and were like, hey, like just wanted to check in, see what you're doing with Bogdanović. Right.
And it impacts Indiana in some ways because we keep hearing about Miles Turner and Buddy Hield being potentially linked to the Lakers. There are other dominoes that fall or could fall as a result of this type of trade. But absolutely, it creates a bidding war. It expedites the process for what's going to happen with these other veterans. And it's a great position for Utah to really be sitting in here over the next 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah, and more than anything, it puts them in a great position for Victor Wembanyama. Like, let's just be real about that. Or Scoot Henderson or the Thompson Twins, whoever you want to talk about in the 2023 NBA draft. It's a terrific top of the 2023 NBA draft. I have a little bit of concerns about like the way that it shapes up from, you know, 5 to 10 or 5 to 12 right now. But guys always emerge, right? It always happens. Cam Whitmore is absolutely terrific. But yeah, at the end of the day, like what are we going with a hashtag right now for, you know, losing for Wemby? Woe for Wemby or something like that.
Yeah, I've heard vie for Victor a little bit out there.
Yeah.
I don't mind
there
that
we
one.
Go.
It's going to be a race to the top there in that draft class. I mean, I think Utah and San Antonio.
Or race to the bottom.
Race to the bottom, whatever you want to call it there. You know, Utah, San Antonio uniquely positioned, I think, in the Western Conference to be kind of the two teams going for it on that front. Yeah. And just I'd be remiss if I didn't throw this out there, Sam. There is a possibility that we watch a Utah Jazz team this year that has Colin Sexton, Jordan Clarkson, Nickeil Alexander-Walker and Talen Horton Tucker all sharing, like who passes the ball in that lineup. I think there's going to be some sneaky league pass potential there, but not for the reasons that you typically put a team on your league pass list. Like, I would love to tune in to see how many quarters they can play with one or fewer assists.
Oh my God. I'm tweeting out. I am That's amazing. I'm like blown away by what that could look like. I like what we have Wreck for Wemby from Kemba, it looks like, in the comments here on YouTube. Stoop for Kemba. Scoot. There we go. I'm all in. I'm all in. Okay. The Knicks now. Let's do this Knicks thing. So for as much as I just said that I think the Knicks should, I think the Knicks offer was a little bit better. And I think that it was. I think the Knicks offer was slightly better than the Cavs offer, as reported by Shams, largely because I don't trust in James Dolan, right? Like, that's what it comes down to. Not because of the Leon Rose of it all, not because of everything else, but simply because the James Dolan of it all, like, our guy's going to want to go play for him, everything like that. Was acquiring Donovan Mitchell the right move for them at the end of the day? That's kind of what it comes down to for me. I don't know that it was. I've always been like a little bit more hesitant on them giving up all of the assets necessary for Mitchell. Like, it's not like when it was like six firsts and like four of those firsts were not unprotected, and it was like Quentin Grimes and Fournier and like Quickly, I was like, okay, sure, whatever, makes sense. If it was going to be like three unprotected firsts and RJ and like everything like that, I don't know, man. Like, the fit between Brunson and Mitchell without the defensive insulation of Allen and Mobley that Cleveland has, that could have like turned out really, really poorly, I think, for the Knicks.
Yeah, totally agree there. Like, my complaint with the difference in New York is literally the front court that New York has. That Julius Randle, the inconsistency there is always going to be an issue. I don't think he's the most self-aware offensive player, nor the ideal four-man defensively to play next to a smaller, you know, lacking a little bit foot speed backcourt. I'm not a huge Mitchell Robinson guy. Like, I just, there's a lot of barely above average guys there in New York for the role that you would have them placed in, that mortgaging your future in such a way by giving up that many picks without moving them into a clear top four or five spot in the East, it puts you in that no man's land that you really want to avoid being in. And that's, it's hard to resist the urge to go out there and get a star player when you're the New York Knicks and you say, we're in New York, we should be good. We haven't been really competitive in a long while. A year ago, we made the playoffs as a four seed. We had a little bit of a setback this year, but we should be aspiring to be on that level. It's hard to have the self-awareness sometimes to step back and say, if we do this deal, we're not a top three or four team in the East right away, and we're mortgaging our future so much to do it that we're losing a lot of our means to improve.
I think that's right. With Donovan Mitchell, what are the Knicks? The Knicks are like, here's a good question. With Donovan Mitchell, Jalen Brunson, Julius Randle, RJ Barrett, let's say they were able to keep Barrett, although it seems like they offered Barrett based off of what Shams is reporting. So let's even say Jalen Brunson, Donovan Mitchell, Julius Randle, Mitchell Robinson, everything like that. Let's remove Barrett from the equation because it seems like the Knicks offered him. Is that team worse? Is that team better than the Cavs with just like the core that they had previously? Like, is that team better than Darius Garland, Evan Mobley taking a leap, Jared Allen, Lauri Markkanen, etc.?
Yeah, no, from me, just simply on the defensive end of the floor. I trust the defensive infrastructure that the Cavaliers have, and I don't think the Knicks can provide that. Like, even if you throw RJ in the trade and it ends up being Brunson and Mitchell and Randle and a couple of the decent young players that they have to fill in the gaps, I don't think that's a better team than Atlanta with young DeJounte Murray and some, you know, John Collins and some intriguing front court depth there.
DeAndre Hunter, Clint Capella, like, yep.
I don't think that's a better team than Atlanta. And I think the timelines with Cleveland and Atlanta continuing to get better, you can get leapfrogged in 3 years by an Orlando or a Detroit as they have really accumulated those young assets. Maybe Indiana enters that scheme. Like, it's 3 years down the line, I don't see the Knicks, if they make that type of trade, being a top four or five team in the East. And if you don't see that, I don't think you can justify pulling the trigger. Whereas I can easily see that for Cleveland. It's the theme of what we've been talking about here today, Sam. It's the Mobley impact on all of this.
Yeah, like you, I don't know. Like you brought up the idea earlier, just getting the star, right? And in New York's case, like there's a real tangible benefit to getting the star, right? Like if you get Donovan Mitchell, it could attract other guys to want to play with Donovan Mitchell. Like you have Jalen Brunson. Jalen Brunson plays great with superstars. We just saw it like in the conference finals, right? I always thought of Donovan Mitchell as like the number two piece. So the Knicks could maybe go out and get the number one. The problem is it's just really fucking hard to go find number one.
Yes.
Like it's just really hard. And it makes it a lot more difficult whenever you're like capped out because you're paying Jalen Brunson and Donovan Mitchell. What? I guess that would be almost $60 million. And look, we can talk about the cap rising as much as we do. And it's an important factor here moving forward. But, you know, you would then have Jalen Brunson, Donovan Mitchell, Julius Randle signed for like $85 million between the three of them. You know, if you were able to keep RJ, you're looking at like 110 then. Like the cap, maybe it spikes to like 135, then like 150, I guess. But like once you start talking about maxes at 150 for like superstar number one assets, you're talking about like a $50 million max to start. And then it escalates from there. I don't know, man. Like, did the Knicks like get away? Did the Knicks like kind of dodge a bullet with this? Like they really might have, I think, a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's going to depend on two things to know if they dodged a bullet. One is, are they
I want to be clear too, by the way, this has nothing to do with like me not liking Donovan Mitchell. Yeah. I love Donovan Mitchell as player. I think he's really, really like, I think that like some of the hate he gets, like in terms of inefficiency, some of it was just, he was so responsible for creating so much in Utah. Once, especially this year, Mike Conley kind of didn't quite have it as much as he used to. He was just responsible for creating everything in Utah. And while he did it on a floor surrounded by incredible floor spacing, he was just kind of stuck, you know, being forced to do everything for them. And that makes it hard, I think. And plus, like, I don't know how great the synergy was between he and Rudy Gobert on the court. I have no idea about like their personal relationship. I don't really care. But their synergy together on the court has always been like a little bit, you know, a little bit off, it feels like. So I think in Cleveland, he's going to be great. Like he'll have a great lob partner and, you know, Jared Allen, he's a great partner in crime, and Darius Garland, like it should be a little bit easier for him, I think. But I think he is a situationally dependent player. He's not so overwhelmingly good. Like he's a top 20 to 25 player in the NBA. He's not a top 10 player in the NBA where like he is going to dominate regardless of what the situation around him is. And in New York, the situation around him was not perfect for him to shine. Whereas in Cleveland, I think it's like actually really good for him to like continue to shine and continue to get better.
Yeah, if he was capable of being the number one option and putting a team on his back and winning postseason series, you'd think we would have seen it already at this point. So putting him in that exact same type of role in New York doesn't inspire confidence to me that the Knicks really become a postseason type of team. I think Cleveland has a little bit more balance offensively. We keep mentioning the defensive infrastructure to really be able to do that. I don't know if I'd say this is the Knicks dodging a bullet. But I would say it will depend on the continued growth of a guy like RJ Barrett, that he has to really continue to get better year after year. And if he ends up being an all-star type of player, then you are no worse necessarily than you might have been in terms of win-loss record from making a deal for Donovan Mitchell, and you keep some of those future assets and younger picks.
One thing I just got a text from is this is now the second big deal that Danny Ainge has struck with Kobe Altman, particularly the Kyrie deal.
Right.
And then now this one. It's a good point from someone in the industry that just texted me. Yeah, very interesting. I think very intriguing deal. I put out the question in the comments to see if anyone has some questions here for us as we kind of close up. Dre asked, can Cleveland be the next dynasty in the NBA similar to the Warriors? I wouldn't go that far. I love Evan Mobley, but like Stephen Curry is one of the 15, you know, conservatively one of the 15 best players ever. Much as I love Evan Mobley, if he's even David Robinson, that's a level below what Stephen Curry is. And David Robinson's what, one of the 40 best players of all time, maybe better. And there's like a significant difference in that. So I think it's really, really hard to kind of envision a Warriors like dynasty, but I appreciate the fact that they could win a title, I think.
Yep. Totally agree.
Who do we have, as this is from Lawrence Field, who do we currently have as the bottom five teams in the NBA as the race for Wemby goes on?
All right. So I threw out Utah and San Antonio a little bit ago as being those teams in the Western Conference. I think in the East, there are several candidates for going in that direction. I would probably say, you know, Charlotte and Indiana, Orlando.
Ooh, Charlotte, that's a big call.
That is, yeah. Orlando, I think, taking another year before they get to that point of being able to win a ton of games. That's one that stands out to me. I also think there's probably going to be one team that we don't necessarily expect that ends up getting down there. Like, I should also say Houston as well, just being young in another year that they'll need to figure some things out. Oklahoma City, we know. I think three, maybe four teams in the West, and then, you know, one or two in the East, whether that's Charlotte, Indy, Orlando, sneaking down there.
Yeah, my immediate reaction was Utah, Oklahoma City, San Antonio. Like, San Antonio, I think, is going to be really bad. And then, I don't know, probably Indiana, Houston, Orlando, like two of those three teams, maybe, like, sounds right to me. Something along those lines.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds about right. I'm a little lower on Charlotte than a lot of other people are. That just wouldn't surprise me if they end up, you know, closer to the All-Star break, doing what Indiana did this year and saying, you know what, we just got to shut it down and see how low we can get.
The thing with Charlotte is that they do have Steve Clifford returning, and you wonder if like that gives them the defensive infrastructure that they've lacked over the course of the last few years, but you know, maybe. With Utah now being hard capped, this is from Luke Brom. With Utah now being hard capped with the sign and trade of Sexton, do we still see Utah as a realistic dumping ground for Westbrook? I think that there are structures where they could do it. Let me look at their cap sheet very briefly. I would imagine that like it would just require them to like send out like both Boyan and Mike Conley as opposed to like just one of them. But I need to take a look real quick while we're like talking about this briefly. Utah right now is, where are they? I mean, they have to be below the apron because they did the sign and trade.
Right.
Where are they? They are at 148 and the apron is 156. Yeah, I mean, they could still make that happen, I think. If they would have to move out both Mike Conley and Boyan. Yep. And not bring any salary back, or even they even still could, I think, bring some salary back. Yeah, it's still a realistic option money wise. It gets a little bit more complicated. Luke is right. It gets a little bit more complicated, but I do think like just in terms of like mechanically, it is possible still. And like, I think that they could make it work.
Yeah, there are probably other ways that you can structure a deal, throwing in different types of players and other things just to get the salary a little bit more balanced.
Yeah, so Boyan and Mike Conley combined make about $42 million. I believe that Russ, I'm going to look up the exact number now. Russell Westbrook is at 47. So that's an additional 5 million. I believe that they're 7 below the apron based off of what I looked at before. Yeah, I think they could still do this. Yeah, I think. I believe. I'm not Danny LaRue. I'm not like quite 100% on CBA stuff, but like I'm pretty good at it for the most part. You know, guys like Keith Smith, Danny LaRue, they're a little bit better at it than I am. Certainly much better at it. But based off of just like doing quick math in my head, I think that they could still make it work. Especially if they also move Jordan Clarkson in a situation like that. Like there's like a three-team deal where like you could kind of do a lot of different, like if you moved out all of Jordan Clarkson, Boyan and Mike Conley in a three-team deal, brought back Russell Westbrook, you could do that, I think, in terms of like the cap logistics legally. And you could also bring back picks. You could also even bring back a couple salaries, I think. So yeah, no, I think that it is still doable and still feasible.
And I'm a U.S. history teacher, so don't ask me to do any math.
you're a basketball coach. You know, we can't ask you to do math as it is.
True.
All right. Those are three good questions. Let me make sure we didn't get any others to close on just in my mentions. By the way, I'm in the middle of what is undeniably like the worst fantasy basketball or fantasy football draft in the history of fantasy football.
Still going.
So yeah, this draft started last week. It's a four round draft where it's a dynasty league and you just have to take like rookies and free agents. We've been going now for 7 days and there have been, I think, 37 or 38 picks made in 7 days.
You've got a week until the season kicks off, Sam. So
I'm concerned.
You gotta hurry things up here.
I am very concerned, to be honest with you. This is where we're at. The last question here that we'll finish on is from Everyone Needs a Smile. Is Troy Weaver as good as Detroit fans are saying? It feels like his two best decisions, Cade and Ivy, were no-brainers, and he keeps going wrong in the margins, overpaying bad big men, dumping seconds. I think the jury is still out on Troy Weaver as like a just general decision maker. I think Troy Weaver is an excellent evaluator of talent. In terms of the way that he creates a roster that fits together, I would say the jury is still out on Troy Weaver. I do have some concerns about the fact that like he continues to just value bigs in the way that he values bigs. And that feels mildly concerning, I guess is what I would say.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there are always going to be swings and misses on different guys, whether that's Killian Hayes. I think that's an easy one to look at and say that wasn't the greatest pick in the world at the situation. But he's had more hits than misses, no doubt about it. He's found some good guys in later parts of the draft. I have high hopes for a guy like Isaiah Livers turning into a rotational type of NBA player. So, again, still way too early to judge a lot of this stuff. I do buy in a little bit more to the direction and the cohesion that the roster may be able to bring together. But if he continues to add big guys, it's a little bit harder to defend. Also, everyone needs a smile. They isn't that who does all of our timestamps on the YouTube channel?
The best listener.
The best.
Of the Game Theory podcast, by far. Everyone Needs a Smile on YouTube is the best Game Theory podcast listener. I'm sorry to everyone else, but like this dude does timestamps at the end of every episode. Just absolutely our king here at the Game Theory podcast. I think that's all I got at this point. I don't know. Do you have any movie takes? Have you watched any movies in the last few days?
No, I have been in meetings galore, back getting ready for the school year to start. You know, my wife and I are binge watching House of Cards right now. It's her first time seeing the show. It's one of my personal favorites. So that's been an enjoyable thing for me to fall asleep at 9:30 PM doing. But no movies for me this week.
Yeah. I rewatched A Time to Kill recently and I still can't quite get behind Kevin Spacey on screen yet, just because of how like incredibly fucked up that dude seems to be, based off of reports and allegedly and all of that stuff. But well, it seems very bad.
And there are scenes in House of Cards that you watch now, having seen, you know, heard about all the things that are gone on, and it's very cringe, very cringe.
Yeah, it's very bad. I listen to as some people know, I'm a big fan of the Blank Check podcast with Griffin and David. It's a movie podcast. They go through directors' filmographies, you know, directors who have had massive success early on in their careers and are given a series of blank checks. And sometimes those checks clear and sometimes they bounce. And I finally got to the episode of Alex Ross Perry, who's a director, diving into Halloween and diving into horror movies from 1960, basically, to 1978, up until Halloween happened. So over the last few days, I've been watching a lot of like older horror movies, because I feel like that's actually kind of a blind spot for me. Like last night, I started watching Let's Scare Jessica to Death, which is a movie that was mentioned on there. It's like a weird, like, psychological thriller movie. Yeah, very, very fun little project for me moving forward. And Philip Flores in the comments here is mentioning Rosemary's Baby. I actually just watched Rosemary's Baby like two nights ago. So yeah, I'm like all in on like that, like kind of area of horror movies right now. Because there, look, here's the thing. This is like kind of a dead zone for the next like couple of weeks here in terms of new releases. I guess I have to go see 3,000 Years of Longing, which is the new George Miller movie with Tilda Swinton and Idris Elba. But like, I'm only kind of interested in it, I guess. But yeah, that's where we're at. This is where we're at in the life of this podcast. Yeah. All right, Spins. Let's get out of here. Please tell the people where they can find your work. Please tell the people what you've got coming this week.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Sam. Fun conversation today. Obviously, really cool to be able to hop on right after some news breaks and just.
Isn't it the best? Yeah.
It's cool to talk. It's the first time I've done something like this, being able to talk about things as the news is being made. Very cool experience. You can find me on Twitter at @theboxandone_. YouTube is my name, Adam Spinella, or my Substack page, theboxandone.substack.com. Gearing up a lot with some college basketball type previews, getting ready for the season there, diving into transfer portal and transfer market stuff a little bit more as we really try to put more of a 2023 NBA draft focus on as the year is really starting. This is, there's never too early of a time to start. I know I've been doing some stuff over the summer, but I am itching to do a lot more draft stuff now because I've been a little more NBA focused the last few weeks. So ready to get back into that.
Earlier this week, I did a deep dive on RJ Barrett. I would go to The Athletic and read that. I think it turned out pretty okay.
Yeah.
I might do a thing on like draft picks and like how three teams own all of the draft moving forward. We'll see whether or not that comes to fruition. But yeah, keep it locked at The Athletic, and we'll be back later this weekend. I'm sure Adam and I, we have a plan. I don't really want to mention what it is yet because it might not come to fruition because we're not totally sure that we're going to have access to what we're trying to do. But we have a plan and we'll be back on recording Sunday night. I know that.
Yeah. Can't wait, Sam.
Looking forward to it. Until next time, though, we will talk soon. Bye.